Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to residents of the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Juanita Stevenson.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, an issue that will impact every voter in Fresno County, redistricting. It is a process that occurs every 10 years to address the changes in population. Fresno County's population grew about 131,000 people over the last 10 years, so changes are taking place. Fresno County supervisors are in the process of deciding and approving new boundaries for their districts. Just how those new maps are drawn could impact who represents you. We have a number of important guests joining us today to discuss this important issue, including Fresno County Clerk Victor Salazar, Fresno State Professor Tom Holyoke, as well as a member of the task force charged with the job of changing the district maps, and Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea, and a representative from the League of Women Voters. So as you can see, we have a full show for you today. And of course, we also want you to join in the discussion. Also on the program, the closing of Borders Bookstore has a lot of folks asking, is there a future for bookstores? We will talk to the owners of two independent bookstores in Fresno and Bakersfield about the future of books and bookstores. But first, redistricting and how the redrawing of maps for Fresno County supervisors will impact you. Some background information from KBPR correspondent Tracy Sharman.
Over the past 10 years, Fresno County's population has grown 17% from almost 800,000 people to over 930,000 people. Most of that growth occurred in districts represented by Supervisors Debbie Pachigian and Phil Larson. Pachigian's district extends from the Sierra foothills to Clovis and East Fresno, including parts of Sunnyside. Supervisor Larson's district extends from West Fresno to Interstate 5. Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke says the goal is for all the districts to have about the same population, 186,000 people.
But since District 1 and District 5 are significantly larger than that, they're going to have to give up portions of their districts. They're going to have to essentially give up constituents. And then the tricky question becomes, well, what part of their districts are they going to give up, and who is it going to be given to?
Supervisor Susan Anderson, who represents District 2, and Henry Perea, who represents District 3, are expected to get most of those residents. Perea needs to add about 25,000 people to meet the target population. Anderson needs to add 7,300 residents. District 4 Supervisor Judy Case is short by about 300 people.
It becomes a puzzle where you sort of rearrange all the pieces to try to get the puzzle to work out.
A task force made up of people handpicked by the supervisors were charged with the job of redrawing district boundaries to reflect the changes in population. They have presented 7 proposals to supervisors. At last week's Board of Supervisors meeting, that number was whittled down to 4. Holyoke sees a potential conflict in having supervisors vote to approve the shapes of their own districts.
Not saying that they would necessarily do this, but it's possible then that they could vote to approve new districts that make themselves even more electorally safe by maximizing their electoral support.
The stakes are high, and some community groups are already voicing concern. Venancio Gayona, chairman of El Concilio de Fresno, says the community did not get to fully participate in the process.
The county supervisors formed a task force, but that task force did not necessarily meet during hours that working people could attend.
A series of public hearings must be held before supervisors vote on their final plan. They have until August 30th to pick new redistricting boundaries. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Tracy Sharman.
Joining us in studio now is Victor Salazar. He's Fresno County Clerk, as well as Tom Holyoke, professor at Fresno State University. We also have Ernie Buddy Mendez. He is one of the task force members charged with redrawing the district maps. Welcome to all of you. First of all, let's talk about the process. And we'll start with Mr. Salazar. How is this What is the law when it comes to redrawing the districts?
Redistricting is currently going on at various levels. The state is very actively involved in redistricting. The distinction between the county of Fresno and what's going on at the state level is very clear. There are specifically three laws that are most prominent in the process. The first is the Elections Code, which requires that counties redistrict every 10 years following the census. It also requires that the objective, it requires that there be as near as equal in population as possible and that there be compliance with the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965. In addition, Section 7 of the county charter also applies. So we've got multiple statutory requirements in the process for redistricting of the supervisorial districts.
And there's also a timeline they have to meet.
Correct. State law requires that the process be completed by the Board of Supervisors by November 1st. But that's the deadline. But to get there, you've got to back up 30 days for the ordinance to have been enacted. So there's a 30-day period prior to November 1st. And then there's the practical application, which requires the Board of Supervisors to make a decision by August 30th, and that must be done by the charter, which requires 4/5 vote of the Board of Supervisors.
Now, what if happens if supervisors don't meet that deadline?
Then by default, state law would then shift the responsibility for redistricting to a special redistricting commission made up and chaired, first of all, by the district attorney, second, the county clerk, and third, the assessor.
You mentioned some guidelines. I'm sure there are rules and guidelines governing this whole process and really what goes into redrawing the district maps.
Certainly. The Elections Code in Section 21500 specifies that the guidelines are to include topography, geography, cohesiveness, contiguity, integrity, compactness of territory, and community of interest. Those are the guiding principles.
And I know, Professor Holyoke, you had mentioned something that puts it in very plain terms, that you know, the reason why we call it redistricting and we have this term called gerrymandering is how the way some districts are redrawn. And, you know, they don't want them jigsawing all over the place.
Yes. Well, you know, the word gerrymander actually is a version of the word salamander, because when this was first done in the United States back, I think, the election of 1800 in Massachusetts, that someone quipped that these weird districts drawn to favor Thomas Jefferson's party looked like salamanders, but they were drawn by the governor, Eldridge Gerry, so it's a gerrymander. But the idea is you can't have these weird districts that snake around all over the place. I mean, Mr. Salazar has sort of laid out a lot of the technical terms, but I kind of like to think of a good district as being kind of blobby. You know, it's all sort of one central blob rather than, you know, like then looking something like an octopus or a snake. You actually should not be able to drive out of a district into another district and then back into the first district again.
Okay. And also, the way we're redrawing the districts here in Fresno County, we have seen this change statewide. We had an election where folks voted that they wanted to take the redrawing of legislative districts out of the hands of the legislators. And so we have a special commission set up to do that. But here we had a task force set up and members of the Board of Supervisors picked members of those task force. And Mr. Mendez, if you are here with us.
Yes, I am.
So that task was given to the task force. Really, what went into this process for you all? What were you trying to accomplish?
Well, I think we're just trying to follow the law as close as we could and not completely rearrange the districts that were out there and take, you know, public input. And we were craving public input all through this process. It was all done, you know, using the open meeting process. and it was all done in the open. There was no such thing as a closed session or anything like that. I think Victor can probably explain that process just as good as I can.
Right, that you were saying it has to be open. I think what I heard, and, you know, when you start a process like this, you're never going to make everybody happy. But there are some groups who talked about the task force meetings were held at a time that working people could not attend.
Well, there was an issue, too, on meeting place, and we were meeting in the supervisors, room, and I think Henry and Victor can explain, the security deal. If you keep that building open at night, we'd have to find a different place.
Okay. So,
but I don't want to state, hey, that's the reason why. I was just, nobody said we had, they didn't want to meet in the afternoon, and nobody said we couldn't meet at night.
Let me just add to that when, the Board of Supervisors back in 2009 initially directed staff to initiate the process. Then approximately a year later, the Board of Supervisors established a task force and the process. And the directives from the board was that the meetings be held in the board chambers and that there be an open process. So it was the meetings were noticed. All of the documents that were presented were available for viewing online. And we certainly made all of those, our process, open and accessible to the public.
Now, Mr. Mendez, how many different proposals did you all come up with?
I think there was 8. And actually, Victor's staff came up with the first 3 as, hey, this is how you do it. It was like, I wouldn't call it a training session, but there's certain things, and it's too hard to go through this program and explain what voting blocks are and how that all works and how the precincts work, and that's something that Victor could add a lot better than I could. Yeah, they came up with 3, and then there was a total of 8. And I thought the process was that we basically favored 4 of the 8.
Okay. And then after you came up with your proposals, you then presented that to the supervisors?
Correct.
Now, after this part is, redrawing the district maps and sending in your proposals, at that point is what you do? Is that just the extent of your...
Correct. It's done. I think, and like I said, again, Victor could tell you exactly what the, I don't know if you want to call it an ordinance or the... the way the county follows their deal. It's still the bottom line. It's up to the Board of Supervisors to decide.
Okay. Stay with us here. And Victor, he was saying when you redraw these maps and the district maps, you're really looking at, aren't you trying to take into consideration a fair representation? Isn't that the bottom goal? Because you talked about, precincts and voter blocks and...
Well, clearly, the objective is equal representation, parity between the districts. Now, that's not going to be possible. You're not going to get the exact number, the same number in each of the 5 districts, but state law requires that you do so as equally as possible. So that's the objective, equal distribution within 5, and that follows constitutional requirements of one person, one vote.
Okay. And it was also mentioned because Supervisor Case's district is pretty even where it should be. She's short, maybe about 300 voters, and there is discussion that her district may not change at all.
Well, of the maps that were presented, that's certainly the case.
Okay.
And if there is any change, it's minimal.
Okay. And as you heard mentioned, is that this now is in the hands of the supervisors. Now, some people would say that might be pause for concern because they are all elected officials.
Well, the reason that the state of California, the people of the state of California decided to change the way that districts were drawn and approved for the state assembly, the state senate, and Congress, the concern was is that because legislators themselves signed off on their own districts, that this was creating the problem of gerrymandering, that we were creating districts that became safe seats, if not for the actual incumbent, then safe seats for the parties, and that was drastically reducing political competition. So in the statewide, we changed that for the state legislature and for Congress, but we haven't done that with the Board of Supervisors. And here we still have the people who are running for election and re-election in their districts voting to approve the shapes of those districts.
And we are joined now by Supervisor Henry Perea. And a supervisor, is that always on a conscious thought in your mind as an elected official? I mean, you're aware that people are looking at the process and wanting it to be fair?
Oh, absolutely. You know, over a year ago when we knew we were heading towards a new census count, we actually commissioned an internal group, which is historically is what the county has done. They appointed the county clerk, our public works director, and his staff, who have access to all the demographic data, and our county administrative officer to draw maps. And we did that this year, and they did come up with three maps, which I think was a pretty good process in that it was more of a bureaucratic folks, you know, taking a look at the, you know, the numbers, taking a look at the criteria, and setting up maps. I think what happened towards the end when the maps were presented, there were some supervisors who weren't quite comfortable with the maps that were presented. So then they went on to selecting a public group to help us out. And I think that was a good idea too, but I think we could have been a little more expansive in terms of who we added to that group. You know, we should have had groups like maybe the League of Women Voters. We should have had maybe people from the education community, the universities, a little broader than what we did. But we did have a good group of folks that were appointed. They did come up with their options of maps. But at the end of the day, it is going to be the Board of Supervisors that makes the decision on which map is actually picked.
Let's take a look here at what we're looking at. Let's look at each district and the number of people they need to add. We look at District 1, which is Phil Larson's district. He has over 195,000 residents in his district, and he is going to have to give up, you know, almost 10,000 voters to make this even. Susan Anderson has only 178,000 people in her district. She needs to add over 7,000. Supervisor Henry Perea, District 3, and you have the least amount of residents, and you need to add the most. That district has a little over 161,000 residents, and that district needs to add almost 25,000 people. And as we mentioned, Supervisor Judy Kaye's District 4, she has over 185,000, very close to what they say is a good number at 186.
Right.
She needs to add a little over 300. And District 5, represented by Debbie Puchigian, has the largest amount of voters at almost 209,000, and she needs to lose a little over 22,000. So what it looks like you're trying to do is add residents, thus voters, to Supervisor Susan Anderson and Supervisor Henry Perea's district.
Correct.
That seems to be it. And Mr. Mendez, was that something when you all were trying to pick these different proposals you were looking at and saying, okay, how can we add these voters in a fair way?
Exactly. And basically, I used the word tweaking. We needed to tweak the districts. And basically, in my observation, the population growth was to the northeast. So basically, And even though Larson's on the west, number one district, the basic push needed to be to the northeast. If we're going to stay consistent and be consistent next time this thing comes around.
Okay.
And that's the way I looked at it. That's just my personal observation.
Okay. And so we look at the maps that you all were presented. Mr. Pereira, what can you tell us about that? You're the supervisor, you were there. And I mentioned, I read that there were seven proposals. So supervisors last week kind of whittled it down to four. What was it in those four that made you all pick them?
You know, I think there's a little bit about all of the maps that we liked, and there's probably a little bit of all of them that we didn't. You know, in the broadest sense, I think the groups, as well as our staff at the First Blush, they followed the criteria as laid out by Victor. But I don't think we were quite satisfied with all of the maps, which is why at the end of the day we voted to include, I believe, 3 or 4 of the maps that were prepared by this group. But we also reserved our right as supervisors to submit our own variations of those maps. And we're going to do that and have that debate on the 9th of August. And I have advised, just as I did the day of the meeting, that I have been preparing a map, and I've already disseminated that to the Board of Supervisors, and I will be presenting an alternative map to also be considered on the 9th.
Some really think that at this stage of the process that I think they were hopeful that you all would move forward with some of the maps, picking one or two of them that were redrawn by the task force.
Yeah, well, I mean, the task force did submit maps, just as staff did beforehand. You know, the bottom line is this. The supervisors, at the end of the day, are going to have the final say on which map is going to be approved. So should the supervisors have input? Absolutely. And we will. And I believe between now and the end of August, which is a short time frame for us to approve it, I fully expect our board on the 9th not just to have a full debate, but I would be fully expecting our board to put all the maps out again to the public, because I don't think they've had a complete public airing. And I'm okay with doing that, because I think people need to see, based on the criteria, what maps are in front of them. And if a supervisor, in this case myself, has an idea of what a map could be look like, would better serve this community, then I think it should be put out there. So I'm okay to do that, and I'm ready to do that on the 9th.
But public hearings are going to be held anyway before any decision is made. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, Professor Holyoak, listening to all of this, what do voters need to be paying attention to?
What voters need to pay attention to is both the process as well as the outcome. The voters need to make sure that the process is open and fair, and that everyone who wishes to have input gets to have input. But voters also do need to pay attention to the way these districts end up looking like, and making sure that they feel that their communities are going to be properly represented. After all, communities are supposed to remain intact in this process, not have district lines that cut across them and potentially, you know, disenfranchise a community because, you know, their concerns might not be met simply because they've been broken in half.
And that seems to be part of the concerns of some of the people that I've spoken to. And you have also made it public and suggested that you would prefer that your district move southwest.
Let me just geographically tell you where what my district is today. If you could visualize the east and west boundaries, Roding Park to the airport. That's the east-west boundary. The north-south would be Shields Avenue. So if that Baskin-Robbins there on Palm and Shields, that's the southern, rather the northern boundary, and it goes south to Jensen Avenue, the community of Kowa. So that's my district now. It's almost in the center of Fresno. What my proposal is to actually move my district north, south, east, and west. So, you know, kind of grow out in all quadrants. With the major goal, keeping in mind all the criteria Victor laid out, is when you go into the area of Kowa, that's where you begin having the industrial part of Fresno County. So my proposal is geographically to have that continuity is to expand south to 99 to the Malaga area. So what that does, even though the population is small, it captures all of the industrial area of Fresno County into one district. Then pushing up to the east and west, it squares off on the 99 boundary just east of 99. But going then to the airport on the west, it captures all of the industrial areas of the airport as well as the population base around it. So going through all corridors, I pick up the 25,000 people in our area. It keeps it squared away. But the goal really, at least from my perspective, is to do what our county board has really never done in the past 30, 40, 50 years, and that is to pay attention to economic development and going into those areas where one individual can lead and impact jobs in this community. That's really something we need to do. If we have one person focusing on jobs and you capture the industrial areas in one area, then I think you can bring a lot of focus. And that's really the goal of that map.
Okay, because when you do look at the map, it's very easy where your district is that you could just move, to the south west and not have to go into the northern part of the district where, you know, you look at Supervisor Anderson district, and she's just sort of locked in there. You know, and she really needs to add voters as well. So
you know,
to me,
yeah, it was interesting. I think one of the directions we gave early on is, and it made sense. Supervisor Anderson needed to add about 7,000 people to her district. But if you look at a lot of maps that were presented, they were taking 10,000 out of her district, 12,000 out here, 10,000. You know, it was really a. Just a mismatch of whatever they were doing. And really all they needed to do was take a sliver of Supervisor Pachigian's or Supervisor Larson's districts and just carve it right into her district. And they didn't do that. So, you know, you can do these things a whole mishmash of different ways. But the bottom line is you got to keep the lines pretty consistent. And as Professor said, you can't be driving in one district, leave it, and then come back into it. That doesn't make any sense. So I think if you look at the maps at least the map that I presented, it's a combination of probably two of the three maps. It's a hybrid of two or three of the maps that have been presented already. There's not a lot of ways you can cut this pie. It's pretty basic.
But when you look at it, we've also mentioned, though, that Supervisor Anderson also needs voters. And, you know, her district is kind of in a precarious situation because she's not running for reelection. And so it's the concern about, you know, her really having a voice.
Actually, if I could just weigh in on that, it's a very good point to make. We keep referencing Susan Anderson as if she was running for re-election, but it's District 2 that would need to have voters added. But it is conceivable that we could end up with a result here where District 2 gets kind of carved up and rearranged. You know, political decision-making is like water and that follows the path of least resistance. And the supervisors need a 4/5 vote to approve new maps. Well, then you could have a situation where that comes at the expense of District 2 simply because Susan Anderson, not running for re-election, does not have a stake in this political debate. And therefore, we could have a rearrangement that tends to favor the other four districts at District 2's expense. And that can be an issue of concern and something voters ought to watch out for.
And I think that's a great point. And I think one or two of the proposed maps by the group was going to push my district into the Fig Garden area. And that was an absolute concern of Supervisor Anderson in that, you know, that's a community of interest. You can't break up a community like Fig Garden and have two representatives in it. So we've pulled back on that. And I think once folks see the map that are laying out, they're going to be – District 2 is going to be just fine. It'll be a small sliver of territory near the airport that will be carved into her district from Supervisor Pachigian's, and it has right about 7,500 people in it. So it'll be a non-event as far as what happens in District 2. It'll stay 99.9% intact as it looks today.
So as people can see, this is not an easy process, and you can understand why it can sometimes be contentious,
sure.
But it's something that needs to be done. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with more discussion.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. We are back now talking about the redistricting of Fresno County supervisorial districts. And joining us now is Terry Friggs with the League of Women Voters. And, you know, what are you all's concern in this whole process? What are you watching?
Well, for us, it is a lot about process. And it seems as though the commission that was appointed did everything by the book in terms of having the meetings and noticing them and having them open to the public. And the last name is Figgs.
I am so sorry.
That's okay.
And so as you heard, too, when you listen to the supervisor's point of view, they all have something at stake here.
Seemingly so.
But in the end, we're talking about the representation of voters and people in these areas. And I think one of the things that kind of stuck with me when you, if you listen to Board of Supervisors meeting and if you've been following them, you usually end up having a 3-2 split on the Board of Supervisors when it comes to a lot of issues. And some see it as those who are more conservative and those who are somewhat, the Republicans or the Democrats, even right. though you don't look at parties in a situation like this. And so you can see why when it comes to trying to redraw these boundaries, they want people to think about what they want out of their representative,
right?
As far as who will support or certain issues.
Yes, and again, that's part of the concern of when you do something like this, drawing new districts, that you want to be a little careful about taking a group of people who are not ideologically in line with the person who's likely to represent them and put them into that district where they're going to maybe be completely marginalized. I mean, sometimes you have to do that, but you need to be very careful about doing something like that. I mean, you know, theoretically, an elected official should represent all constituents equally. In practice, it often doesn't work that way. And that's part of the reasons in that we're not allowed to break up communities, because that can dilute the representation, the quality of representation for the people in the community who've been broken up.
Okay. Do you all see any possibility that could possibly happen?
Well, I've been looking at the maps pretty carefully, and you know, I don't see where any one of the options represents that big of a change. But I'm not familiar with some of the areas where the maps are being the districts are being redrawn to know how it's going to impact the people that live there.
And I had a chance to just look at some of the plans. And really, most of them are very similar.
Right.
The only one that I kind of looked at is when they had District 2 moving into, like, District 3. And I thought, oh, gee, both of those have so few people, and you have all this room to the north and the east and the west that you might want to look at that.
Yeah. To me, it seems like it would make more sense to take from the big – I mean, there's a couple of small districts, and then there's a couple of big districts, and it seems like taking from the bigger districts to include in the smaller districts would make more sense, because most of it it's developed and industrialized, or it's urban as opposed to country.
If you're listening, we would like to hear what you think. If you have any thoughts on redistricting and your concerns or what you would like to see, please give us a call at 275-8989 or our toll-free number at 1-800-224-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. Now, this process is, from what we understand, on the supervisor's point of view, supposed to be done by the end of August.
Yeah, I mean, there's Victor Salazar had sort of mentioned some of that, and there's certain procedural requirements and legal requirements that have to be met on time in order for this all to get done. And if the Board of Supervisors doesn't take action, by the August 30th deadline or something, that it goes to a 3-person panel. And Victor had kind of laid some of that out, but that's kind of important to have, because my guess is that the supervisors don't want to have an independent panel have the final say on this. So this will probably pressure them to come to a conclusion, to really vote on a final map sooner rather than later.
Okay. But the process will be done by the time of the next election. And what you're looking
at
may not be that big of a change for people. But I think what we heard from Supervisor Perea is he's looking at it in a broader terms. The county is facing some serious problems, so it's looking at, let's say, how can we configure this so that when it comes to trying to get policy to help, you have the best possible chance of doing that.
Well, I certainly think that's a good goal to have, you know, and I don't know if that can really be accomplished just by moving the lines a little bit.
Yeah, and there does need to be – it seems to me that there needs to be a couple dramatic breaks and changes. I mean, District 5, Debbie Pachygian's district, needs to lose people. Her district is too big population-wise. Where are those people going to come from? Is she going to give up the more urban part of Fresno and Clovis that she has and then become more of a rural district? Is she going to lose part of that rural district? And if she loses that, who does that go to? And is that going to become some kind of a, you know, horse trading where she maybe District 5 loses some, you know, voters who are maybe not inclined to support the incumbent there, and they go into a different district where they might feel more ideologically aligned? That kind of horse trading can happen. I've seen it happen in other states where I've lived and watched redistricting processes.
Well, we've already heard from Supervisor Phil Larson. I think it was printed in the Fresno Bee last week that he said he would be willing to give up Southwest Fresno. And then his district would probably be more all conservative because of Southwest Fresno. He is representing some minority groups. And then because he received a vigorous challenge during his last election in regards to that. So you can already see where they're saying, I don't mind giving up this part.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, again, the part of the thing you have to watch out for is to make sure that people aren't drawing themselves into districts that are essentially safer, because that reduces political competition.
And that has been the concern statewide, which is why they had it, elected officials, we voted to have them taken out of the process. Do you ever see anything like that happening on a local level? As far as the way we did statewide, that the whole process of redrawing district lines are sort of taken out of the hands of
having an independent commission that makes the decisions.
Right. Yeah. We have an independent commission that comes up with proposals, but as we heard Supervisor Henry Perea said, in the end, the supervisors are going to make that decision.
No, I actually can't think of any locality that I'm aware of that has used a purely independent commission.
That's what I mean. I know they haven't, but do you ever see that ended up being a process for people? But that's something voters would have to decide on, correct?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that if they wanted to move this and make it an independent process.
I think if they don't do a good job this time, that could be a possibility in the future.
it may be, because it seems to be an idea that's been sweeping through California.
Right.
I mean, initially the state decided we're going to have an independent commission do the state legislative districts, and then last year we decided we're going to have them redo Congress, the congressional districts for the House of Representatives as well. That might just continue to spill over into how we do county districts and city council districts and, who knows what?
Who knows what, especially in the political climate today. Well, we'll be back right after this break.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Welcome back. For some, the closing of Borders bookstores seemed to signal another nail in the coffin for book lovers, another reminder of the fragile state of an industry being taken over by technology, e-readers, and Amazon. But in Fresno and other Valley towns, some independent bookstores are not only doing okay, some are actually thriving.
We just have to ring Mom up, is all. Mm-hmm. Then I think we're good.
Diana Ferrari is accompanying her mother to what is one of Mom's favorite places, the Fig Garden Bookstore located in Northwest Fresno. Jean Ferrari has been coming here since the store opened more than 24 years ago.
These are just friends that happen to own the best bookstore around, and it's just wonderful. I can just come in here and relax, and if I need something, they'll order it, just like that.
Jean stops in at least once a week, and so does Jim Woodward. He's here every Friday. What draws him in?
The owners. We talk family. We have very similar experiences with children and grandchildren. But then occasionally we do get on politics.
Owners Jean Shore and her daughter Kathy Leminski believe the personal relationships they have built with their customers over the years and their brand of personal service are keys to their success.
I think the fact that we care about people, I care about the community, it's very important to us to be a part of the community, to service the community in the best way possible.
Some small independent bookstores like Fig Garden have been able to survive challenges that have forced others out of business. First, the onslaught of megastores such as Borders and Barnes & Noble. And now, the growing technology. Everything from e-readers to online retailers like Amazon. Shore says they didn't ignore the changes they saw coming to their industry.
Immediately started thinking, what should we do to offer something more to the customer than perhaps they're going to be able to get at the other bookstores?
So they diversified, adding children's books, educational toys, gifts, and the work of local artists. That has all added to the bottom line. But Kathy Leminski believes the bookstore's connection to community and its people are what keeps them in business.
With Facebook and cell phones and all of the connections that we're making that are sort of faceless, I think it's even more important for stores like ours, and there's a lot of stores like ours, that you get that personal connection.
One of those other bookstores is a Book Barn in Clovis. The store is not only surviving, it is thriving.
We've come really a long, long way.
Yeah, we're very proud.
Over the past 12 years, Dan and Peggy Dunkley have seen their small independent bookstore grow from being able to offer their customers 20,000 books to over 200,000 books, both in the store and online. They have survived by creating their own little niche in the book world.
We wanted to create a place where people would come and be able to find some of the older out-of-print books that are no longer carried by a lot of the new bookstores.
That uniqueness, as well as being willing to embrace the internet early on, added to their success.
The way that it is now in the book business, you can't really buy unless you have an open store, and you can't really sell unless you, or sell well, unless you're on the internet also, and you have to be able to do both.
A Book Barn embraced the technology and built customer loyalty by not saying no. If the customer wanted a specific book, Dan and Peggy wouldn't stop until they found it.
The first time I came in, there was a book I was looking for about 2 or 3 years by my favorite author, and no other store had it or was willing to look for it, and they had it, and it was autographed by my favorite author at a really good price.
21-year-old Nate Dotson has been a loyal customer ever since. He now volunteers at the store.
We're astounded by our customers.
A lot of those customers are busy helping the Book Barn move into a larger building. The old location was only 1,200 square feet. The new building, 8,000 square feet. Now they are busy putting up bookshelves, unpacking hundreds of books, and cleaning up, creating the kind of atmosphere that will make people want to sit and read for a while.
The atmosphere of the place is going to be very comfortable. You're going to have places to sit and to peruse your book, or to look at the art books that you want to look at, or to to sample a chapter. Just sit down in an overstuffed chair or overstuffed sofa and relax and be in a nice, comfortable atmosphere.
The owners of these small, independent bookstores express sadness at the closing of the Borders bookstore. Kathy Leminski at Fig Garden says the closure of such a big bookstore has far-reaching implications in the book world and is hard to see the closure of any place that showcases books. But Dunkley and many of his customers believe there will always be books and a place for those who love them.
Kindles and Nooks are wonderful things. They have their place, but there's nothing like holding a book and turning the page. There's nothing like the smell of a book. I can't tell you how many people walk into our store and say, oh, I love that smell.
Oh, we do love that smell. Joining us in the studio today is Dan Dunkel with Dunkley with a book barn. And we also have Tony Russo of Russo's Books in Bakersfield, both very longstanding independent bookstore owners. And we also want to hear from you on this topic. Again, let me give you the numbers, 275-8989, toll-free 1-800-224-8989, or you can email us at talk@kvpr.org. And what we want to know from you is, do you prefer the convenience of a Kindle or the traditional feel and smell of a printed book? What's your choice, and what do you think about chain stores like Borders closing? So give us a call and join in the conversation right now, Mr. Dunkley and Mr. Russo.
Yes.
Both of you, from the latest, let me share with you some numbers that I have. It says that according to the Association of American Publishers, in 2009, U.S. book sales were $23.9 billion. That's not shabby. That represents about 1.8%. That's a 1.8% decline from 24.3 billion book sales in 2008. Now, e-book sales reached $313 million in 2009. That was an increase of 176%. And Amazon says it is now selling more Kindles than it is books. So when you take a look at that, do you think we can see what happened to bookstores, the same thing that happened to kind of music retail stores?
You could, when you look at the numbers like that, we're talking about new book sales is what most of those numbers reflect. There is nothing taken into account for the used book market, which is huge. Amazon is going to say that they sell a whole lot more for the Kindle than they do for anything, and they probably have increased. But that doesn't take into effect their used market for used books. I'm not sure what type of store Mr. Russo has. I have not seen his, but it looks as though to me I'm getting more and more customers that are looking for older, out of print, a specific title, a specific edition that they just have been looking for a long time, and that's where my forte comes in.
Now, Mr. Russo, I think from my understanding, your bookstore, you've been around, what is it, 20, 21 years?
We've been around 22 years.
22 years. And you recently moved to a new location too, didn't you? A larger one?
No, we closed a store in a shopping center when Mervyn's and Gottschalk's went out of business. We were in that same shopping center.
Okay.
And we closed that store and just consolidated to one store in the Marketplace Shopping Center.
Which is the huge shopping center in Bakersfield.
Right.
And so what do you specialize in, or what do you think are the secrets to your success?
We're a general bookstore, and our secrets really are customer service, knowledgeable people, and all of our people read books. They are book lovers, and they have a lot of retail experience. And that's the main thing. And then we do a lot of events. We do almost every weekend. We have local author signings and a lot of big-name signings. We had Mike Huckabee here last year doing a book signing. We've had Dr. Laura here. We've had a lot of big book signings, but it's a lot of local people. If there's a local book coming out, they usually contact us, or we contact them and do a lot of promoting of it on the internet and in store.
Is it that a local bookstore, if it's operated in the right way, you become a part of the community, so that is what makes you different than one of the chains.
Right. Each year, Bakersfield has like what they call it, one book, one Bakersfield, and try to get the community to read the book. And we are the main bookseller of that book. This year, it's The Other Westmore. We give a discount on the book, and we try to get encourage people to read the book. And then we have discussion groups in the store of the book. That's real big.
No, Mr. Dunkley, you also mentioned that at your big store, your bookstore, you're very involved in the community as well.
I think that's really important. You can see with Mr. Russo and the lady with Fig Garden books, they always stress the community involvement. We're looking to, at the new store, we're looking to have more community involvement, more book signings, poetry readings, book clubs. The more that you can get the community involved and become a community fixture and offer the customer service that everybody has mentioned, you know, book lovers to book lovers, that's the key. And you become a part of that. And that's, I think, why it will never go away, both the independent news stores and you stores.
Do you think that what we might see, because unfortunately with the closure of some place like Porter's and then Barnes & Noble's, there was talk of them also being sold, but I think that might be from market to market as far as what happens to them, that even if, you know, they can't survive, you think there will always be a local independent bookstore?
I think there will. Again, to stress the customer service and community involvement, the large chains cannot do that, and they won't do that. They can't. It's whereas you have a smaller group, you know, that is based here. They know the community. They know the trends and they stress to find what their customers want and need. They need to take care of the customers.
Also, for both of you, Mr. Russo as well, you talk about what you provide and that your bookstores, you know, they become a destination point for people. This is, you know, this is where, as you saw with the Fig Garden, she had people who came in every Friday or this day, and I'm sure that might be the same for you all. This is just a place where people want to come.
Yes. We do poetry reading every Saturday night, and we get a real good crowd for that. We also have a sports card and gaming in the back of the store. And every Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we have tournaments for young kids and older kids. And we have comic books, and that's a big part of our business. But it's always somebody in the store, and there's always something happening. Well, like every Wednesday, the new comic books come out, and we get people waiting to come in to pick up their comic books. We take subscriptions where they can pick them up and give them a discount. But it's always something happening all the time. There's between the card shop, the comic books, the gaming, the books, the poetry reading. And another thing that publishers are doing and helping out, like this recently, Ivanovich's new book, Citizen 17, they offer the independents autographed copies of their books. And we do that every time they offer autographed copies, we take them. And they do that for the independents.
Okay.
Yeah, that is, you know, as he said, you make something special of yourself. And that relates to the customer service and to the customers. They feel, you know, I don't know of too many other places that actually would have their customers volunteer to help them move 50,000 books or 100,000 books. You know, books are trees, basically. It's wood. So it's very heavy. But, you know, I have and I'm sure Mr. Russo has his regulars that would just love it so much that they come in and help no matter what.
Yeah. So. We heard that a lot from both of you.
For a book, and we came second place in the nation for it. And it was the customers came to volunteer to help put on the event. And that's happened with the Harry Potter books. We've had 1,000 people out for Harry Potter parties, things like that. It's just and the volunteers you get is unbelievable.
And let me mention, we have heard from some of our listeners on Facebook, and let me read to you what they had to say. One from Leda in Visalia, She goes, in Visalia, Borders was the only big chain bookstore, fun place for locals to hang out and have a cup of coffee. Unfortunately, much of its merchandise was overpriced. Of course, the limiting of accessibility to books is never good, but I'm hoping this gives a great boost to our local indie bookstores that could sure use the support. And from David, he writes, the big boxes use cheap money from Wall Street to expand while local brick-and-mortar retailers are forced to commercial lending at higher rates. Over time, we collapse local economies in favor of big box retail, and then when they retreat, you are on your own. And also, we need to mention when we talk about these independent bookstores, you know, there are a number of them in not only Fresno County, but I'm sure in Bakersfield. I can remember, you know, taking my daughter to Petunia's Place. They've carved out a little niche for themselves because of their children's books and their children's reading hour and, you know, making it a place for, you know, parents to bring their children. And isn't that what you have to do if you are a local store and you want to survive?
Most definitely. The niches that you can create and you gather people around you, that is the whole thing. You have to become something special. You have to have community involvement. We're co-sponsoring an event with the Fresno County Libraries, Friends of the Library, coming up on August 10th. It's a book drive. We're incorporating with Channel 47 a huge drop-off for books so we can collect used books to be donated to the Fresno County Friends of the Library. And then at the end of August, we'll have a huge book sale, probably 50,000 to 60,000 volumes, the way that it's looking, to be held at Sierra Vista Mall. That kind of thing gets the entire community involved. It raises the awareness of reading and literature, and that's something that has to be done for any of the bookstores to survive. And the more that we can work together with our customers to determine what they need, the more we pay attention to our customers, the better it will be for all of us.
But we do that quite a bit all the time. In fact, at Christmas time, we work with another group where we give a discount for people to buy new books that to be donated to a charity for kids who don't have reading. We do that with schools also. We drop offs. Actually, they could buy a book with a big discount, and we'd be donated to the schools.
Okay, and one of the things that I have noticed when I talk to all of you, each bookstore owner that I've talked to, you all have book lovers in your family. You talked about your daughter loving books, and one reason you did this. And then you talked about, we talked to another person, Fig Garden. They opened their store because their daughter loved books. So if parents pass down that love of books, you'll see this generation after generation. But first, let's hear from Jane in Fresno. Jane?
Hi.
Yes.
One of the things I'd like to say is I think that the small independent bookstores offer that one-on-one help to customers. I see that particularly with parents coming in looking for just the right book for their child or an adult looking for a book for a gift. And when you go into a big box store, you don't get any help. But when you go into local independent stores, they know you, you know them, and they can help you find just the right book. And that's so crucial in today's world because we have, frankly, in schools, since No Child Left Behind, teachers can't offer as many books to kids anymore because they have scripted programs to teach. So we have to have some place in the community that helps parents find just the right book to excite their child to become a reader. And putting the right book in the hand of a kid makes such a difference.
You're so right about that. Sorry, we are running out of time on this. And I love the discussion because I'm a book lover, too. And like to thank all of you for participating today. And just go out there and support your favorite bookstore and read a good book. That is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. And for audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore. I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.